Betterbeck, Bix Betterbeck from about 70 years ago. Barnacle Bill the Sailor. I wonder if that's where they got Popeye from. And this is Terrible Tommy, Tom Metzger in the bunker right here in North Central Indiana, right next to Terrible Tommy's Terrible Tavern Steakhouse and Filling Station, where we sell only Ethel and regular. And that's right next to our Weapons of Mass Destruction used equipment yard, chuck full of stuff, man. And of course, when we closed up, we were almost empty, but we've been refilling because we're closed during the winter months, and that's when we bring them all in here. Chinese been helping me out a little bit, been getting that stuff over there, that the that second class stuff that ISIS don't want. It's not good enough for them. So we take that secondhand stuff, and the Chinese bring it up the Mississippi River and right up in here and through the river system into Indiana. Put them in our yard out here, polish them up, paint them up, grease them up, and get ready for the spring offensive. It looks like we may really have a spring offensive this year. I keep waiting and keep waiting. We'll see. Some guy downtown suggested I get into the drone business, but I don't know about that drone business. What do you think? I don't believe in this mechanized, weaponized stuff that you can kill everybody from 10,000 feet in the air. I'd rather have mine right up close and personal with a knife or a gun, maybe. A knife or a sword. That's a gentleman's way of fighting. You got to hand it to the black KKK. A lot of those boys just use a razor. And boy, if you've ever been cut with a razor, woo, you don't even know you've been cut. Well, let's get back into our pessimist guide to history. Today we're going to cover the peasants' war in Germany. They really got it on. Every once in a while, the little people rose up and kicked the shit out of the big people. But not enough. Not enough. Okay. A.D. 1524 to 1525. The young women knelt before the mob of rebellious peasants and begged them to spare her husband's life. The two-year-old child she held in her arms squirmed and began to cry as the peasants angrily pushed her aside. Meanwhile, a young rebel danced merrily before her, laughing and playing the death march on his fife. The woman's husband, Count Louis of Helfenstein, and his republican men were forced to stand against a wall while the peasants, armed with spears, rushed at them in an angry mob. Beware, George Bush Jr. and Cheney. All were killed, including Helfenstein's wife and baby. His wife's body was tossed on a nearby dung cart. The peasants' revolt in Germany continued for nearly a year. A religious reformation did not necessarily inspire the revolt, but it had a strong influence, like it usually does, unfortunately. Leaders like Martin Luther had through his, and that's not the nigger, this is the real thing, Martin Luther, through his teachings encouraged the peasants to think about religious liberty, to refuse those who forced their beliefs on others, and to realize their own importance as individuals. Erasmus remarked to Luther when they witnessed atrocities in the bloody revolt, quote, "We are now reaping the fruits that you have sown." The peasants of Germany had long resented the inequalities in the class system, their lives of hard work and low pay, like slavery, and the taxes levied upon their meager incomes. They were ready for a revolt when a group of villagers in the Black Forest rose up against an abbot on July 19, 1524, because he refused to let them select their preacher. Before long, people in the neighboring towns joined their ranks, and by January of 1525, dozens of German provinces and towns were in open rebellion, man. I like it. The peasants soon issued a list of 12 demands. These included the liberty to choose their own preachers. Oh, jeez. Out of the frying pan into the fire. The abolition of tithes and slavery. Yeah, white people were slaves. Duh, Mr. Nigger. And the right to hunt and fish where they pleased. Well, that was the main one. Yeah. Martin Luther's first reaction was to urge the princes to be merciful to the peasants. Some of their demands, he insisted, were reasonable and should be granted. He warned the peasants, however, that their conduct was outrageous, that they wanted their own places to fish and they didn't want slavery. That's outrageous. That they were acting like heathens. Well, I love the heathens. I'm a heathen myself. And that duty of Christian is to be patient, not to fight. There you go, the key words to Christianity insanity. Yeah. Don't fight back. Be patient. You'll get your reward in the sky someday in heaven. You sit at the right hand of the Lord and eat cracklings and pork rinds. Like all the other niggas. Because they're all going to heaven. You white people, you're going to hell. But the rebellion had developed a momentum of its own. The peasants began to wander through the countryside, waving a tricolor flag, black, red, and white, as a signal to revolt. Black, red, and white, a symbol of revolt. Isn't that quite interesting? Soon they became more violent as well, plundering castles and killing all who resisted. We'll get those ruling class bastards who have been enslaving us for centuries. The imperial army was brought in to quell the revolt. As usual, They marched to town where the Count of Helfenstein and his family had died and burned it to the ground. We'll show you peasant bastards. In battle after battle, the professional soldiers easily defeated the poorly trained peasants. Well, I guess that was before, or they may have forgotten about guerrilla warfare. Fighting like the Red Indians, man. Though their ranks grew weaker, the peasants still refused to surrender. Both sides committed bloody atrocities. Well, that's what happens. When the army discovered the young man who had played the fife before the unfortunate woman and child, they chained him to a post, built a fire, and watched him burn. Finally, on May 15th, the army surrounded the peasants. Unarmed, the rebels had drawn their wagons in a crude circle for protection. Many were ready to give up. Still, their leaders urged them to resist and insisted that the arm of the Lord bless their cause. Oh, yeah? You're right. Just then, it said, a rainbow appeared in the sky, which many saw as a sign of divine protection. Oh, we don't need to fight now. Jesus is protecting us. When the peasants still refused to surrender, the army attacked in force. The peasants ran for their lives, but there was no escape. Some 5,000 of them were killed in a bloodbath, while Jesus stood by and watched. Martin Luther's Protestant Reformation movement brought war as well as profound social and theological questioning. Well, another whack job. He wasn't as whacked as the Pope and all those people, but he was still a whack job. Well, let's do one more here. I get so excited, I get almost sexually aroused when I read this stuff. Sorry. 1527, the sack of Rome, one more time. This occasion began with the Duke of Bourbon, a Frenchman, who was very upset with his King Francis I. The Duke negotiated with the Holy Roman Emperor and Henry VIII of England to divide up France. Isn't it, see how the ruling class operate? They say, the king says, well, hell, I want part of France. I want this part and I want that part. Oh, okay. Just like our New York Wall Street people and the corporations in the military-industrial complex say. They go into the Middle East, well, we want this. Let's get rid of this leader. We want that, and we want this. And anybody who stands against us is anti-democratic. The king discovered the conspiracy and was duly upset, but he failed to capture the escaping duke. After a few skirmishes, King Francis was captured, but released when he promised the duke he would return to France and keep his possessions. But the king reneged, don't they always? So the emperor made the duke the governor of Milan, but he didn't give him any money to support his army. Oh, I gotta have my army, man. What am I gonna do without my army to pillage and kill? Lacking resources, there was only one thing to do, of course, and that was to sack Rome, of course. That's always the idea. I want to sack Chicago. How about sacking Cleveland? Sounds like a good idea to me. On May 6th, the Duke led an unruly army of Spanish and German mercenaries into Rome. When does it ever end? Those Germans, they've been mercenaries a long time. There, the soldiers began a long, continuous orgy of violence and destruction in the city, rich with long-accumulated treasures and Renaissance artworks. They attacked the unarmed clergy, nobility, merchants, and other Roman citizens with rapacious greed. Well, the clergy, yeah. Nobility, yeah. At least a lot of the merchants, yeah. But other Roman citizens, that was out of bounds as far as I'm concerned. Citizens were tortured to make them pay ransoms or reveal the whereabouts of hidden valuables. Gangs of drunken soldiers dragged women out of their homes or nuns out of their convents and raped them. What's new? What's new? It happens all over the place. Vietnam, Korea, Europe, Germany. Happens in the Middle East, all over the place. But we're pretty good at covering that stuff up. As all semblance of order dissolves, soldiers roam the city, murdering, torturing, and looting at will. Incredibly, the lawless violence and chaos continued unabated for over 9 months until the army finally withdrew. How about that? How about that? Now, the next story, which I'll get into tomorrow on Thursday, Mother Nature gets involved. You know, you get whacked by the army and whacked by the ruling class, and along comes nature and she whacks you. Is that called turning the other cheek of your ass? Well, here's a letter from one of our incarcerated friends. First of all, I'd like to say Happy November. A while back, you sent a book called Horace Saves. What was it about? Horace Saves is a book about how to use religion to conquer the world. It's sort of an allegory. It doesn't really talk about race at all. But the prison wouldn't let it in. And like I say every day, hate those fucking prison administrators more than anybody, or just as much as anybody, because they enjoy making life cruel for white people. You know the niggers get all kinds of stuff in there. All kinds of militant stuff. Hate whitey stuff. But every time you try to send anything that has a little bit of white culture or white resistance, they refuse. Not much goes on in prison. I got some pictures coming soon. Did you get the prison newspaper articles of us at Asatrua? They've got an odinous thing going on in a lot of prisons, which is fine as long as you don't start believing all that stuff. I mean, it's, I like Odin and I like Wotan and I like all those people. I like even, I danced with Broomhilda one time, but if you start believing there's, you know, I'm not kidding you, Wyatt Kaldenberg, my friend in the old days, he was getting drunk on Odinism and he began to believe there was these entities roaming around the sky. Well, that's just as crazy as the Christians. But if you treat it as a respect for history and the mythology of history, Odinism is great. And I'm sure in prison it works out real good. Oh, another thing, the black female problem with Richard Scutari was that he refused to cellmate with anyone but a white man of his approval. That was another reason the nigger broad wants him to do 10 more years for that. 10 more years. Think of it. The guy goes on to say, a quick note on race in prison. Upon entering most any prison in the world, one of the first things are noticed is automatic need or urge to segregate. This happens because it's instinctual. It goes against nature to attempt to do otherwise. Survival is the best way to put it. Typically, if one is not there for their race or tribe, they are shunned or worse. So you see in the prisons, they recognize it immediately when you walk in the gates. You're expected to handle your business. Weakness is not only, can't read that word, I guess frowned upon, but it's not tolerated. Worse, even the people here will try to exploit this. Animals sense weakness. It is my experience that fear is the only true great, can't read that word. The outside world can live in an ideological, illusional, utopian farce, But faced with a truly difficult scenario, people will naturally segregate themselves out of a need for the pack mentality. To both feel safe and survive, most will not be put in this situation unless you're one in a million badass such as myself. I can and will survive anywhere because I am a can't read that word. An apex predator. Sky right, stay right, and stay white. And as always, strength and honor. He added a little postscript down here. Laziness is born out of a false sense of entitlement. Entitlement is born out of an illusion. Delusion born from weakness. And weakness is only overcome by courage, because courage is not a lack of fear, but what you do when faced with it. And this is honor. And I like that. Sounds good to me. That's when you really know. You don't know anybody until it comes down to the wire. Like I've seen so many guys go into court and end up pleading out instead of saying, not guilty and I have nothing to say. Almost no white person, mainly white men, will stand up to the system and say, I have nothing to say. I'm not going to talk. You're not going to get it out of me. You're going to threaten me with 1,000 years in prison? I'm not talking. How many white men do you know like that? I've met very few. But believe me, there's more and more of them coming online because I get little hints and notes from people that they understand and they take the five words. And the cops don't even continue the conversation, or the detectives, or the federal agents. Once you've said, I have nothing to say, they know exactly where you are and where you're coming from. Or they'll say, you're one of those Tom Metzger guys, huh? That really impresses me. What really pisses me off is to get a letter from someone in prison that not anybody I knew before, or even whether they committed a racial act to get into prison. But they start communicating and over a period of time, and then somebody in prison down the hall gets into the act and writes for material from me. And then they proceed to send me letters attacking each other horribly, calling each other names and lying and everything else. Well, obviously, I don't know who's telling the truth in prison. I have no control over what happens in prison. Hell, a black guy could write me and I wouldn't know the difference. I'd probably figure it out, but you know what I mean. So here's these white guys got nothing better to do than attack each other and create lies against each other. And I just have to tell them, I don't deal with that. I don't deal with that. I have no periscope that I can look over the walls and know who's telling the truth. So I'll just scratch you both from the list. Sorry. Sometimes you got to be brutal. Well, I went in and talked to the Planning Commission yesterday, which are actually pretty good people. They're friendly to me and they understand the situation, but they're sort of bound by the letter of the law. And I said, well, let me ask this. How much time do I have to get rid of my sign or take it offline? And they said, well, you have 30 days from the commission hearing. And I said, well, then what happens? Well, a period of time will pass and we'll send you a letter that you're not in compliance with the ruling. And I said, then what happens? He said, well, then that period of time passes and it's handed over to the city attorney. And I said, well, then what happens? Well, they'll send you a letter that you're not in compliance, and unless you cease and desist, well, they're going to start fining you. And I said, well, how long does all this take? He said, well, it could be a pretty long time. They've had some people that were for months and maybe years. So I said, well, you know what? And then he said, you know, you can't appeal this. And I said, yeah? He said, you can go to Superior Court and file an appeal, and which I should have asked before. So I think that what we'll do, I'll go down to the Superior Court today and pick up some paperwork, and I'll get ready to file an appeal. But the appeal is going to be based on the constitutional freedom of speech. It's not going to be based on whether the sign is 2 foot wide or 8 foot wide or 100 foot wide. So that's what I'm going to do. And I have some legal advice from lawyers. I think I'm going to bundle this all up and send it to the ACLU. Now, don't laugh. I'm not an idiot. I know about the ACLU. But sometimes they happen to pick a case and come across. So I'm going to give it to the ACLU, and I may get a local attorney to go pro bono. I don't know. But I think it's a very winnable case because it's not based on size of a sign. It's not based on how long a sign is up. It's based on the freedom of speech. And freedom of speech should always trump all this other little bullshit. So anyhow, that's the game. We never quit here, you know. If you people that know me know I never give up. And I've already, through our good buddy back in New Germany, he's sending me an electronic sign, and we've already had at least one or two people give me donations if I have to buy a new electronic sign that's smaller. You know, those ones with LEDs, they're bright as hell, and they're not very big, but they scroll the message. So no matter what, we're going to have a free speech sign in front of Tom Metzger's abode in front of the bunker. And they can all go to hell if they don't think so. I also go around and put little one or two line ads in papers. Now, it's funny, the paper that won't print my letters will take my ads because you have to pay for the ad. And that's the mentality of the ruling class. But there's another little paper that I put one in last week, JesusNeverExisted.com. I went in this week to put another one in, and they said, well, we can't do that because technically that's not your website. They called the main office, got the big Clarence Darrow involved. I said, well, let's do it this way. We'll put JesusNeverExisted.com. That's my website. I've got a lot of that stuff up there anyhow. So she said, hold on, and she calls the main hee-ho, and he thinks a little bit, and he says, yep, that's legal. He can do that. So we figured a way around that obstacle. There's always a way around an obstacle. Too many white people give up. They won't fight, but you got to fight. In other words, you got to wear the bastards down to where every time you show up at their office, they say, oh, Jesus Christ, here he comes again. Give him what he wants, anything, just get him out of here. This is a side issue, but last Saturday night, the local Moose Lodge had an Elvis impersonator and a Frank Sinatra impersonator come to sing. And I haven't had so much fun in a long time. These guys were great. I technically prefer the Frank Sinatra act a little more than the Elvis act. Number one, he sang that goddamn song In the Ghetto. What are these white guys think that they're throwing a bone to the Negroes by singing that damn song like no white kid ever has the same problem? Have you heard that song? In the Ghetto. I hate that song. Anyhow, Frank Sinatra, he did a great job. And Elvis did a good job until he got to that song, and then I was ready to barf in my beer bottle. He did almost as much as that song, Stand Up, Stand Up, I'm Proud to Be an American. Remember that song? God, I hate that song. I won't stand up. I will not perform any act of allegiance to this system because it's not our system. It's been gone a long time. Forget it. They all get up at these places and they hold hands and shit, you know, like a religious revival. I'm proud to be American, where at least I know I'm free. Ha! Bullshit. Do anything the system don't like and you'll see how free you are. I'll bet you haven't heard of Uzbekistan. One of the old Soviet republics. Well, this example of how Washington works. Last week, this may be a little dated, the London-based Bureau of Investigative Journalism published a story about a sting against Bell Pottinger, a major British public relations and lobbying firm. Journalists worked for the Bureau approached the firm in the guise of seeking PR help for Uzbekistan, the torture-loving former Soviet republic that has been known to boil prisoners to death. A Bell Pottinger representative told the undercover journalists it could introduce Uzbekistan officials into the political and media circles and help them get better known by a lot of key decision-makers and get a lot more foreign aid from the stupid American taxpayers. In the course of their research, the Bureau met with lobbyists and PR agents who boasted of their ability to get think tanks to publish sympathetic reports about their clients. They also talked about winning favorable media attention by setting up supposedly independent public events and hyping business opportunities for domestic companies. In the United Kingdom, such international lobbying is virtually invisible. Quote, in the U.S., there is a measure of statutory transparency. Lobbyists working for foreign governments have to publicly disclose their client contracts and state when and why they've been in contact with politicians and the media. Unquote. The Bureau noted, quote, in the U.K., there is no such obligation. While it is true that U.S. lobbying and PR firms here are subject to disclosure laws, they and their clients have been able to skirt or even evade them. As I reported here last week, foreign governments and interests seeking influence in Washington use a host of tactics, some identical to what Bell Pottinger was proposing for Uzbekistan, that are largely unregulated and free of disclosure requirements. These include making contributions to think tanks, universities, and nonprofit groups, and setting up business associations that advocate for better political ties with the U.S. but aren't legally defined as a lobbying organization. The Uzbek regime of Islam Karimov, a Soviet-era hack in power since 1991, is a classic example. Uzbekistan does not have official lobbying representation in Washington, yet it has many American friends advocating on its behalf, and because they don't register as lobbyists, it's hard to know exactly what they're up to. Chief among them is the American Uzbekistan Chamber of Commerce, whose board is made up of executives from U.S. companies with interests in Uzbekistan, such as Boeing Aircraft, Honeywell, and General Electric. The usual suspects. The group's stated purpose is to promote trade and investment, but it also pushes for strong ties between the two governments on the basis of its excellent working relations with both. Of course, these ties are always based on money and what the corporations can rob out of these countries by setting up hacks like this fellow that runs Uzbekistan. Multiply this by hundreds of countries. The AUCC is chaired by attorney Carolyn Lamb, a former head of the American Bar Association, who in the past has lobbied for such authoritarian states as Libya and the former Zaire, ruled by strongman Mobutu Sese Seko between 1997 and 2005. Her law firm, White and Case, lobbied for the Karimov regime in Uzbekistan. Lamb has also served as a legal counsel to Xeromax, a Swiss registered holding company widely reported as controlled by Gulnara Karimova, the president's powerful daughter. A September 2005 WikiLeaks cable written by a U.S. diplomat in Tashkent described Gulnara as the single most hated person in the country. Following the 2005 Andijan massacre, in which Uzbek security forces slaughtered hundreds of unarmed protesters, the AUCC's then-president James Cornell wrote to the Secretary of State Condoleezza Negro Rice to urge her not to rush to a conclusion or ignore the thorough investigation carried out by the government of Uzbekistan, and saying that downgrading relations with Karimov threatened several vital interests of the United States. In other words, color that predatory corporations. More recently, AUCC board members and the Uzbek ambassador to Washington held a briefing with House Foreign Affairs Committee staffers. During their meeting last August, they talked up job creation linked to American experts to Uzbekistan and offered their help, expertise, and knowledge for future congressional visits to Uzbekistan. You want a vacation and find a couple of Uzbekistan hot women? Congressman, get on our plane. Last September 28, the AUCC held its annual business forum in Washington, which was attended by representatives of the international financial organizations, think tanks, and policy institutions. Boy, that's a mouthful of bullshit. And featured speeches by Uzbek and U.S. government officials. AUCC President Tim McGraw of Nukem, the aptly named company that serves as an intermediary between uranium producers and nuclear energy utilities, told the crowd that his group's efforts sought to fundamentally strengthen the overall bilateral relationship in case we want to build some more atomic bombs. We've got to have more, you know, because they're after us. The same day, in what was surely no coincidence, President Obama spoke with Karimov by phone and pledged to continue working to build a broad cooperation between our two countries. This was just 4 days after a Senate committee at Obama's request voted to waive Bush-era restrictions on military aid to Karimov dictatorship in exchange for its help moving military supplies into Afghanistan. Oh, one hand washes the other. All of which was surely gratifying to the dignitaries gathered at the AUCC forum. My request for an interview with Lamb made through the AUCC was declined. Asked if the chamber had advocated for the waiver on military aid to Uzbekistan, Elena Sun, the organization's executive director, said by email, the AUCC asked the U.S. government about the waiver for additional and better awareness purposes. Whatever that means. The chamber, she said, was not a lobbying organization. At least on top of the table. Under the table? That's different. And its advocacy efforts aim to inform the American public and governing institutions about why better bilateral relations with the Republic of Uzbekistan matter to the U.S. geopolitical and business interests. Remember, always follow the money. Among the speakers at the AUCC's event was Professor S. Frederick Starr of the Central Asia Caucasus Institute, CACI, at Johns Hopkins University, who has been a reliable companion of Karimov and other former East Bloc tyrants. Following the 2005 Andijan massacre, Starr went on NPR and echoed Karimov's justification of the crackdown as necessary because Islamic militants were behind the demonstration. CACI later co-sponsored an event with the Hudson Institute that debuted a short video offering the Karimov regime's take on the Andijan crackdown, an account of the event at eurasianet.org. said that Starr sought to undermine the critical reports about Andijan by saying journalists had an anti-government agenda and were lying. CACI refused to provide me, this is the author of this article, with the current list of donors, but over the years they have included a number of U.S. oil companies. Surprise, surprise. Active to the region. Newmont Mining, which has big interest in Uzbekistan. Caspian governments had funded individual scholars at CACI, which has also boasted in a brochure about the institute of its close contacts with the Washington embassies of various countries in the region. In his approving comments about Caspian governments, Starr, an advisor on Soviet affairs to Presidents Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush, sounds like one part of an old line Soviet apparatchik and one part Borat. One former student of Starr told me that he became notorious in the classroom for his predictable whitewashing of each and every Central Asian despot. Even Sparmurat Niyazov, the former leader of the Turkmenistan, who built a cult of personality to rival Stalin's and who named himself Turkmenbashi the Great. So ardent was Starr in talking up Niyazov that students took to calling him Starmanbashi. Anyhow, you need to hear this kind of stuff once in a while. Maybe a little boring, but this is, this is how American corporations and British and others corporations control the world. They literally control the world, and they make deals with the very worst people in the world. And they don't do it because they're white. They do it because they're green. They want the money. Always follow the money.
You see, we believe... Well, let me put it like this. There are Jews in the world. There are Buddhists. There are Hindus and Mormons and then... There are those that follow Mohammed's foot. I've never been one of them. I'm a Roman Catholic, and have been since before I was born. And the one thing they say about Catholics is they'll take you as soon as you're warm. You don't have to be a six-footer. You don't have to have a great brain. You don't have to have any clothes on. You're a Catholic the moment that came. Because every sperm is sacred. Every sperm is great. If a sperm is wasted, God gets quite irate.
Every sperm is sacred. Every bird is sacred. Every bird is great. If a bird is wasted, God gets quite irate.
in vain.
From the hilariously funny Monty Python list of songs. I love humor. The different movies that they made, the shows they made, funny as hell. Probably Life of Brian was my favorite. If you haven't watched Life of Brian, you got to. Well, the agents of the Empire do not always arrive with warning when you're besieged, surrounded, and infiltrated. Imagination is often your best weapon against the oppressors. All you have at hand is some duct tape and a disposable camera. Fear not, you have the makings of a powerful laser. A disposable camera contains a super cap, aka high value capacitor, which stores up a charge to make that bright flash. When you press that flash button, you can hear the capacitor charging up in an increasing high-pitched tone. We're going to take out that flash and replace it with two metal leads. Instead of traveling through the flash bulb, all that stored energy will travel through whatever we press the leads to. So, let's see what the materials needed for that. Shouldn't be much. First, the disposable camera, and then the wire, duct tape, and Velcro. The best part about disposable cameras is that they're free if you go to your local convenience store and ask for the used ones. I even got a disposable video camera. Remove the paper covering from the camera if you plan to on disguising your taser as a disposable camera. Then do this step carefully and replace the paper shell at the end. It's a double-edged sword, though stealthy for insurgency. You can also easily kill someone who's ignorant of it, such as children, so be careful. With the cover gone, you'll see the AA battery. Remove the battery. The camera is held together with a series of plastic clasps. Once you unclasp them all, the two sides of the camera will come apart. This is the inside of the camera, and they show pictures. You can get this off the internet. Do not touch anything yet. The supercapacitor may be charged. If you accidentally discharge it with your fingers, you'll get a very painful and potentially deadly shock. Before touching anything, we must safely release any energy stored up in the supercapacitor using a flat-headed screwdriver with a plastic or rubber handle. Bring the tip of the screwdriver into contact with the two leads coming out of the side of the capacitor. If you hear a loud pop and see a spark, you have safely discharged the cap. If you hear or see anything, try again several times. If you still get nothing, your capacitor has probably already been discharged. The board is not screwed into the plastic case and should come out with minimal force. Leave all the metal bits as they are. Locate the flash box at the top of the board. With a pair of wire cutters, cut the leads that connect the flash box to the board and discard the flash box. Double check your screwdriver that the capacitor has been fully discharged. Cut 2 7-inch lengths of wire and strip the ends. Wrap the exposed ends of the wires around the capacitor leads. It is important to wrap them tightly enough so that they cannot touch each other. turn the other ends of the wires, or run the other ends of the wires through the empty flash opening on the front of the case, put the circuit board back into the back case, and close the entire case around the board. It feels good from a design standpoint to create another function for the opening we first must obsolete. Take the exposed ends of the two wires and tape them in the opposite end of the camera away from the flash charge button. Do not, under any circumstances, touch these contacts ever. It's time to test the functionality of your taser on an inanimate metal object. Hold the taser so that the contacts are facing away from your body, pressing the flash button to charge up the supercapacitor. After a few seconds, touch the contacts to the metal you're testing it on. There you go, that's about it. Made a case for mine from straight green duct tape. The bright color ensures that you will always be aware of the taser. I felt compelled to add a safety flap to cover the contacts when the taser was not in use. I also added a battery packet to ensure that the user cannot be charged accidentally in my pocket. Well, there you go. There you go, boys and girls. There's a cheapo way to have a very effective taser. Well, today was my luncheon with my class of 1956 bunch of people. We still got about 35 of those people still kicking. How about that? But I'm going to tell you something. They're getting worried. They're getting scared. They're asking each other what to buy, silver or gold. Should they buy guns? All this kind of stuff. Normally, I don't hear that kind of talk from them, but something's changing, and they wanted to listen to me a little more than they usually do. How about that?